WPFW News in Washington. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features reflections on autonomy, direct democracy, and maroonage with Madibo Kadale, Part 2. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Uhuru by Osibisa. And we play that as we remember Osibisa's founder, leader, Teddy Osei, who joined the ancestors yesterday, January 14, 2025. Following up from our show last week, today we'll listen to part two of a four-part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, maroonage, black anarchism, and atheism with Modibo Kadale. Here is Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope with Dr. Modibo Kadale.
The idea of democracy and its attendant operative mechanism, democratic citizenships, specifically the right to belong, is often lauded as a gift of Greco-Roman sociopolitical thought and Western European and American cultural contributions to a specific conceptualization of what has come to be known in academic discourses as modernity. From this historical cultural perspective, a concept was needed to determine what it means to be human and belong in a particular form of socio-political organization and economic logic. However, moving beyond rhetoric, paying critical attention to the origins of this worldview, democratic citizenship as expounded by the Athenians, the lauded form of socio-political organization that was intellectualized by an Athenian elite, was conceptualized to exclude others. The inclusion of others was seen as a negation of order and the rule of law. After all, was it not Aristotle who invoked the notion of jus sanguinis, meaning right of blood or by blood, to be an exclusionary tool serving the interests of the dominant class? Moving forward through the 10th and 13th centuries with intra-European religious cultural war informing the foundational impetus for the nation-state, the stage was set for a process of alienation rooted in a racial superiority as a hierarchical and commodified economic world order was refined in the intellectual and practical milieu of the 14th and 15th centuries. What is important to highlight here is that by the time the 14th and 15th centuries arrive, the concretization of the previous period of a limited articulation of what it means to be human becomes fully rooted and a justification for and maintenance of private property, which informs capitalist logic birthed from a protracted process of alienation as the basis for cultural religious supremacy, all firmly concretized in the legitimacy of nation states, the creation of colonial borders, exchange of value based solely on fiat currency, binary constructions of gender and race, etc. What is clear in our current historical epoch, as Modibo Kadale aptly points out, younger people are convinced that the nation-state is not offering them a future. Newer generations of researchers are now beginning to look for evidence of community and collectivity, a collectivity that lies in the very fabric of Africana forms of knowing and ways of being, fully articulated in the various forms of resistance such as those found throughout the Americas expressed as Maroon communities. In defining, mapping, and attempting to find the most articulate expression of democracy, Modibo Kadale presents an important intervention. One point of entry into his contribution is in Intimate Direct Democracy, Fort Mose, The Great Dismal Swamp, and The Human Quest for Freedom, which is a clear disruption in dominant discourses. Kadale engages interdependent themes such as Black autonomy, radical public and social history, intimate direct democracy, social intimacy, Black geographies, and radical ecology, while centering a Pan-Africanism that strengthens the conceptual lens through which continuities in Africana socio-political thought and resistance can be further identified, explored, and contemporarily applied. Kandale's perspective on Black autonomy, grounded in social intimacy as being the essential mechanism for a functional democratic society, is undoubtedly rooted in his own background. Kandale grew up in Rice Barrel, a Gullah Geechee community on the Georgia coast, where he often points to Africana ways of being and forms of knowledge that were transmitted from generation to generation and deeply ingrained in his worldview throughout his early development. His work is a delinking of Africana historiography and historicity from the American narrative, and thereby a delinking from the Greco-Roman Western project to construct a particular form of democratic society. Its exploration of space geography as a foundation for liberation is a vital contribution to a range of categories of knowledge production, with the primary form of Marinage as the fullest articulation then and now of Africana resistance as a catalyst for thinking about a new society. We see reverberations throughout the practices and thoughts of those categorized into a Black radical tradition, which has now reached a point of being gutted and overused by a particular class of Black neoliberal intellectuals who present as radical. But we'll set this aside for now. Modibo Kandale argues that the problem of human survival in the face of rapid and catastrophic climate change is beyond the understanding of current, antiquated socio-political praxis. It cannot grasp the scope of this catastrophe, which by its very nature demands a new politics beyond the realm of exploitative global capitalist enterprise, zealously protected by the armed forces of competing empires. Since we know there is a social crisis at the basis of every ecological crisis, or that every ecological crisis is in reality a social crisis, consequently, ecological crisis can expose social crisis. Now, in the 21st century, we can confidently say that hierarchically organized societies cannot solve or even adequately address ecological crises. In fact, such societies with their nation-states, empires, and capitalist markets have shown themselves to be the cause of widespread ecological destruction. If Pan-Africanism, as recent history demonstrates, is going to be defined by the unity or clustering of Black-ruled nation-states and Black capitalism, it serves no purpose other than the continued expression of Black exploited classes under Black elites. Dialectically, the concept of Pan-Africanism is perfectly compatible with the development of locally decentralized and directly democratic institutions in areas where ordinary Africana people live and work. In other words, properly organized and applied, a Pan-African social ecology can be a framework that orients our direction to realizing a new society. A vague outline of a people's Pan-Africanism began to emerge within the discussions and the clashes of concepts and ideas that were playing out within the 6th Pan-African Congress at Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. It was by no means the dominant perspective at the Congress. However, since that time, it has become clear that when most activists try to conceptualize Pan-Africanism, they typically mean it in the sense of a pure incrementalist statecraft. Nevertheless, it cannot be ignored that there is great danger in the statist conceptualization, as they can take us in a backward direction. For Kandale, Pan-Africanism can be used as a directly democratic people's framework, particularly applied to local struggle. It can be applied in the same way as the indigenous people's movement or a working class people's movement, not for the reform of the nation state or for a nationalist movement, but as a decentralized anti-state movement rooted where Black or indigenous people live and struggle. A non-exclusive movement, including all local activists who are engaged in autonomous self-organization and the creation of directly democratic institutions that can respect and find camaraderie with and within all oppressed groups. To be more clear, Kandale's direct democratic worldview is rooted in what is called a neo-Pan-Africanist tradition, which in turn find roots in the writings of C.L.R. James, Guyana's Yusi Kwayana, Jamaica's Joseph Edwards, and resonates in the work of Ella Baker and political prisoners Mumia Abu-Jamal and Lorenzo Cambon Irving. Neo-Pan-Africanism is distinguished from classical Pan-Africanism by the questions of state power and ecology, where classical Pan-Africanism assumed that freedom for African peoples could be attained through the emergence of African state power. Neo-Pan-Africanism clarifies that state power itself is inherently oppressive, ecologically destructive, and ultimately counterproductive and counterintuitive to any genuine democratic movements. For Modibo, orienting this worldview to excavate and examine the histories and contributions of Maroon communities in the Americas, paying attention to the Great Dismal Swamp and Fort Mosey, where various groups of African peoples from a variety of cultural and socio-political traditions cooperated unitarily and democratically built communities where they defended each other from the violent logic of plantocracy, is deeply informative. Today, we will listen to autobiographically the origins of Modibo Kindali's perspectives on direct democracy, autonomy, Marinage, Black anarchism, and atheism. Part 2 will engage this development in more detail. Part 3 will extract paying attention to the application of this experience and ideas, while Part 4 will provide a few thoughts on moving forward. Dr. Modibo Kindali is a social ecologist, movement intellectual, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, Black power, and Pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. He is author of Pan-African Social Ecology, Speeches, Conversations, and Essays, Internationalism, Pan-Africanism, and the Struggle of Social Classes, Intimate Democracy, Fort Mosey, The Great Dismal Swamp, and The Human Quest for Freedom, and a number of other articles. During the 1960s, early and middle 1970s, Modibo Kindali was an active member of a number of radical formations. In the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, he served as a member of the Central Staff and chair of the People's Action Committee in Highland Park, Michigan. In the International African Liberation Support Committee, Kindali was a founding member of the National Steering Committee. He chaired the Detroit Local Committee in 1972 and 1973, and then continued as a member of the expanded International Steering Committee as a representative from Atlanta, 1973 to 1975. Within the 6th Pan-African Congress, he chaired the Southern Regional Organizing Committee from 1974 to 1975, and was also a member of both the North American Delegation and the North American Left Revolutionary Pan-African Caucus. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly. Enjoy the program.
Thing that was being debated then was, were there classes in the Black community, or was that class analysis irrelevant? And so what I did is I wrote a pamphlet saying that it was, and did a class analysis. It had two essays in it. One essay was called "The Class Origin and Nature of Contending Ideologies Within Black Society."
And this was the primary question, obviously in the community, but also in movement spaces, because obviously
So I was calling myself contributing to that. And the young people at that point, man, they ate it up. I mean, that was us then. I mean, those were the young people. We were done. And a year later, that rose as I wanted to show how it was important for practices and mobilization too, you know, but you had to do the analysis that I wanted to offer. But later, I realized that it was a part of the what was being debated in the ALSC then. Mm-hmm. They went after it, man. I just sat back and watched. And I said, "Well, look here." Yeah.
So talk about a little bit of, you know, this notion of, you know, race and class. Of course, this is coming out of, by the time you get to the African Liberation Support, you know, period, you're coming out of Detroit, right? And this question
Black proletariat at the point of production. Yeah, right. I was clear then.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Yeah, because you talked
to the people weren't, you know, and then in the ALSC, the people who were mobilizing these people were coming out of poverty pimp tradition too, you know. And that's basically the praxis that informed their ideological thinking at that time.
This notion of race and class, I mean, of course, you know, C.L.R. James is in this particular space. He's wrote as far back as what, the 50s and also 30s on this particular question as well.
And Du Bois.
And Du Bois.
Black Reconstruction, sure he was.
Absolutely. So that informed the work, not only because one of the things you just said, I think, is important. Having an intellectual debate of the notion of race versus class, or the practice of race and class analysis, becomes two different types of frameworks, right? Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Because and of course, it guided our. Where do we emphasize our mobilization? Do we go into first? Do we take money from the government? Because a lot of people were being elected to local positions, and even the National Black Caucus. As a matter of fact, the National Black Caucus sponsored the panel at Howard, and they were new, and they were disoriented. Really, they were, but they were black, and they wanted to mobilize some black people. So when I saw that at Howard, I didn't want to jam up a Wusu in them, but I wanted them to focus on class analysis in the black community so that we can mobilize the people. And so we decided in Detroit that we weren't going to have no black politicians on the platform speaking, because they deserve no special privilege. They could walk and they could march in the parade and participate with everybody else. And the second thing is, we wanted to make sure that the everyday working people made a contribution and began to have knowledge of the struggle in Southern Africa, you know, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Angola, and South Africa too, and of course later Zimbabwe. But the thing that I was emphasizing is that was important to our practice. It wasn't just an intellectual debate. And we were able to mobilize them. And then the next, I was arguing in the International Steering Committee to decentralize the next demonstration, take it out of Washington, put it in Detroit, put it in Youngstown, Ohio, and put it in Greensboro, North Carolina. Put it in D.C. too, you know, D.C. was part of it. And then have a criteria for judging people, not by their rhetoric, but by how much money they raise from the masses, not by no corporate donations, and how many people they mobilized at their local ALD demonstration. That determined where you went. Do you go to City Hall, or do you go to the factories floor? Do you go to the factories to mobilize people? Do you go to Congressman John Conyers and dictate or become a part of your committee, or do you have the everyday activists part of your committee? And so we were in this meeting after the ALD 74, we had a meeting. And all we were interested in is not no talking. How many people came to your demonstration? How much money you got in? Or a real criteria for praxis. In retrospect, that was a turning point in ALSC. So to me, ALSC did not break up. People look at it as, well, it broke up over these meaningless discussions. But no, it just changed form. It morphed. And other organizations came about. You know, that's what happened. People began to see that. And of course, what's the name of that organization in the late 80s that occurred and it was re-centralized again? What was that organization called?
You're not talking about Trans-Africa, are you?
Trans-Africa, yeah.
Okay.
And when the history is written, Trans-Africa gets credit for mobilizing support for those struggles. In addition to that, when those people, even in the areas which were in struggle, they didn't know about us, but we tried to put it on the agenda for them to move forward.
So I wanted to go back to this notion of the decentralization, because I think that is a very important, because what happens is that if it becomes so centralized, and you're talking about the movement, the African Liberation Support Movement being centralized in a particular geographical area, that also pulls intellectual resources as well. Spreading it out becomes important in the context that now you're also paying attention to what is happening at the local level. if you're moving around in a particular place. So this decentralization is also a theme, right? Because the dictates become important, how things coalesce or concretize themselves into very, very inflexible ideological instances become important. Talk a little bit more.
A lot of local at that meeting, as I remember that meeting after the decentralized effort, there are a lot of local people that many people hadn't seen came to that meeting. Yeah. And they were talking, because we had the meeting in North Carolina and it was a retreat, and it turned into a real ideological struggle. And that's when the LSC started. You see all that literature that began to be generated at that time. And it's based upon class, but they say Marxist versus not. And it was a very important part of Leroy Jones, Imam Baraka's transition. He was a straight up cultural nationalist when he first joined the LSC. Just before he died, we had a conversation about that. And he thanked me. I said, "Well, what did I do?" He said, "Man, you cleared up." But he was sick then. And I'd just come back from Africa. We talked in D.C., matter of fact.
Okay. One of the last sentences, I remember he was actually in D.C. and a few months later, because he was doing something, Tom Porter actually was with him in D.C. as well, because he was at the Bohemian Caverns, I believe. And then, months later, I think it was January of February, something like that. But let's piggyback, really quickly, because there is a number of debates.
If you look at that tape, Baraka was attempting to answer the question about the Black Regency, but Owusu dismissed the question. Baraka was really trying to get at it, and he was. You could tell he was. It was turning over in his mind. See, Baraka is a real transitional figure. He went from the Black Arts Movement to the cultural nationalist stuff, and he ended up being a Marxist of a sort. But he always was rooted in Newark. And so you can trace, in many ways, you can trace the transition of the movement through him. He was really trying to deal with something. Really, he was.
Thank you for interjecting that, because this notion of a Marxist of a sort was actually a better way that I was actually going to form my question.
Yes.
Because their practice, also intellectual merging with that. It's interesting that you said that. I'm glad you interjected. I don't know if you were kind of on my thought process of what I was leading to.
Well, but the material conditions developed, yes. And we're just tracing what was happening in the mass movement, really.
Yeah. But a lot of people miss that point, though. I mean, folk really get caught up in one side or the other. So talk a little bit more about this, because all of you are moving in a particular space, and the material conditions, the objective conditions, the country, all of these things are becoming apparent. But at the same time, you all are very clear about, the merging of these particular categories of thinking, race, class, gender. Talk a little bit more. Obviously, this is also, we're talking about Mir Baraka, but you are literally moving in this particular space as well.
Yeah,
like you are, your thoughts are moving in a, some would say in a particular advanced understanding of really coming to a realization of the inhibitors, nation state, these particular structures that are inhibiting the evolution part. Just, jump in there any way you want.
Trans-Africa was a resurrection and a throwback. It was, a lot of people look at that as the pinnacle, but that was the way in which history is rewritten and distorted. It was let me just say this. Pan-Africanism is an ideology rooted in international activism. It was a clear projection of where the world was going, but it centralized and focused, or at least most of the sections of it centralized and focused on the nation state. And that's why you got Nkrumah coming out so hard. But, he got deposed. He ended up in Guinea. He ended up dying. Then he ended up, just like Barack, he ended up putting out a book called Class Struggle in Africa. So his transition was to what I call neo-Pan-Africanism. A Pan-Africanism rooted in the masses that was a part of the anti-imperialist struggle, The imperialists tried to co-opt it by interposing certain nation states and putting certain people, certain classes in power. So you can't go from classical Pan-Africanism to neo-Pan-Africanism without a class analysis. You can't do it. Intellectually, you can't do it. So pivotal to that, as you point out, is Du Bois, CLR. These guys were trying to make the transition to neo-Pan-Africanism. In the meantime, you had a parallel struggle, a concomitant struggle on Black studies, Afrocentrism. Afrocentrism is a ideological academic discussion mimicking, but it's the shadow of the Pan-African. It's an epiphenomenon of it. It wasn't real. Let me just explain what I mean by epiphenomenon. Epiphenomena is something that is real, but it's not real in the form that you can see it. I mean, it's like moonlight. Moonlight is real. You can see it, but it's not really moonlight. It's reflected sunlight. So the Malefi and all the guys who are struggling in the academic arena, they're epiphenomena of a mass struggle in the third world for Pan-Africanism. They never developed a class analysis. They didn't have to because they didn't have their feet in the mass struggle. So they end up being on cloud nine somewhere, if you follow them. And so there's no neo-Afrocentrism. They swallowed the state paradigm, hook, line, and sinker. They were looking for Black kings, male kings. They were looking for Black societies. They were just saying that y'all said that it was European. We got some African Europeans too, you know. So, but it was an epiphenomenal reflection of the Pan-African struggle, which was moving from classical Pan-Africanism to neo-Pan-Africanism. So I have to make that distinction. Sometimes people just clump all of them together and they can't go nowhere because they don't have the definitions of the terms that they're using. So it's hard to discuss things with them. They know it. They know every goddamn thing, you know. But they get to define the terms. They get to define the terms of the argument anytime, any way they want to. So it's hard to follow them. But there's some real people who make the transition and try to deal with it. I think you have to respect Nkrumah for that. You know, and you have to respect Du Bois. Look at the journey of Du Bois. But the people who are leaving now, Garvey was not, he didn't make a transition very much. He was stuck. And if you don't watch it, we can get stuck too, you know, because things are moving on. And I'm fortunate to have, you know, long life where I can see that. It's like I noticed that in CLR. CLR, if he died in the 1940s, we would know him, but we wouldn't know what he could have become.
The transition becomes important. And that transition is not, if I'm reading you, you know, very clearly, it's not just this non-materiality. There is, you know, you're kind of whimsical. You know, these transitions are based upon, you know, obviously the conditions. And as these conditions are changing as well, which is important because we're in an epoch now that things are, when you talk about factory floor, we now have to add in gig economy. Right.
Yeah, you do.
We have to understand that the evolution. So how do we understand, you know, those particular transitions and how we address the contradictions that also reinforce the systems of oppression become important?
Let me tell you this, young man. you got to be brave because you ain't gonna never become no president in no school. You ain't gonna never become, you can become a head of a department until they start fighting and then they'll fire you. Du Bois was brave. I mean, that guy went through a transition. He was purged and he formed something else. Then he went, tried to go to the Black colleges. They fired him. Then he went up north. So he was still struggling. And so the transition is based upon a certain amount of intellectual honesty and downright courage. If you're on a career track thing, yeah, you ain't gonna become rich and famous. Not while you're living anyway. Well, you ain't gonna become rich. You can't become rich when you're dead. But you just gotta be brave. Look at CLR. I mean, he went to Trinidad, and his good friend Eric Williams put him in jail, man. Look at Nkrumah. He tried to do it, that he made the error of misjudging things. He ended up in exile. You know, he could have been assassinated, really. So it gets deadly, really. And so you got to be intellectually brave and honest, because the masses will take you places that are very uncomfortable to go. But you got to go. You got to go. And when I look back at my career, I lost a couple of wives behind me. I mean, these women married me when I was one thing, and then when I became something else, they couldn't go with me. So it was the marriage. Or stay contemporaneous with the masses were doing. And you're always behind the masses. People, the Marxists used to tell me at AU, oh, you're tailing behind the masses. I said, yes, that's what I'm doing. I'm tailing right behind them. Wherever they go, that's where I'm going to. who's leading them? I said, they're leading themselves. They're leading us.
Right.
Following up from our show last week, today you're listening to part two of a four-part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, maroonage, black anarchism, and atheism with Modibo Kadale. Dr. Modibo Kadale is a social ecologist, academic, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, black power, and pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. The music in the background is Kurima by Chinewiso Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation between Dr. Modibo Kadale and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope.
And also that comes out of understanding a sense of honesty of being humble in one's intellectual journey as well. So, you know, trailing behind the masses is a very important framework to understand that when you're talking about the academy and you're talking about people who are in particular spaces who consider themselves, they want to be out front. And, you know,
If you show me a guy, I'll keep you interrupting. If you show me a guy who's never been fired, and I show you a guy who don't have no real courage or intellectual honesty or anything like that, you got to be fired 5, 6, 7, 8 times.
or marginalized or pushed away.
People going to talk about you.
And it's funny that you say that because, of course, in my own particular spaces, there's a constant tightening and disregard and attempts to kind of quell or push, some of the work and stuff that it's not about me. It's kind of like I'm following, as you say, I'm following the trajectory of what folk are doing in the streets, right? I'm literally trying to understand how do I merge my pedagogy, my intellectual processes at the same time thinking intentionally about these structures and institutions that support where movements, particularly working class folk, go. And this is where I'm leading to in your particular conceptualizations of, the notion of direct democracy and Southern labor organizing. All of these things become important. Could you talk a little bit more about, those particular experiences, working class experience? Of course, we talked about Detroit. So you have that. You're moving in between, institutional spaces and universities, but you're still connected specifically to, movements that are happening on the ground, and particularly ecology, right? Looking at the role and the importance of the ecological system. Could you talk a little bit more? Because I think we're at a particular point now where I think folk are seeing that we are getting to a point where you have a sharpened ideological stance. You've written, Pan-African ecology, you've written, you're moving, again to what people will consider to be black anarchism, those type of things. Talk about how all of these particular experiences have really sharpened, and what does direct democracy mean? What is black anarchism, and how it literally influenced or widened expanded these experiences in your intellectual development as
well. Well, you got to live life and go. You got to go and experience things and understand it. You know, you got to be able to understand that what they see and what they taught you, at best, that's epiphenomenal. At best. And so you have to figure out what's really behind it. What is the essence of it? You know, CLR wrote in the book, Notes on the Dialectic. He said, you have to struggle. You have to look for the essence of the thing. The essence of the thing is not visible to your eye. It's a conceptualization of it. And so once you see that and are comfortable, my mother used to tell me this. She said, she told my father this. I need to correct the record too. My father disowned me in 1965. But by 1967, he was calling me almost every night. They'd fired him too. And my mother used to tell him, he said, the boy is not going to be what you want him to be, but he's going to be what he wants to be. So let him be that. Let him do that. And my mother gave me the support that validated the direction in which I was going. A lot of people don't have that kind of person in their life, you know. And my father always cued my mother and said, well, whatever that boy do, you always with him. And he says, Evans, he's doing what he wants to do. You know, let him do what he wants to do. He's not asking you for no money. He's not asking for this, but he's not doing so and so. Well, he's not, but he's not living in our time. But when you find a concept that works for you, and an analytical tool. That's why I went to CLR back in 1960. It was 71, I think. And I wanted some tools of analysis. That's what I wanted. I didn't want to be out there and not being able to explain myself. So I knew, first I knew all white people are not smarter than black people. Do that. If anything, black people might be smarter than them. I knew that the music and all the cultural things didn't resonate with me. But when I played my horn, I was playing what black musicians play, you know? So I was rooted in the culture. I was rooted in the history. So if I had the analysis along with that, it didn't matter to me how much money I made. I didn't, you know, I made a conscious decision that I wasn't gonna get involved with some people that would hinder my own development and my own understanding of the world. And you do get a feedback too. Like when I wrote that first pamphlet and I sold it out in a matter of minutes and people were reading it, then you know you're on the right track. And then you talk to people and then some people are gonna tell you not to do what you need to do. And you feel conflicted, but you also feel compelled. And then when one thing turns out all right, and you look back and then you see the war in Vietnam, well, number one, you see segregation disappears. You see structural changes, but you also see reaction to that. You see the war in Vietnam is over. You see the draft curtailed, and you understand why it is, because you got to keep living, you know. And then you see the people that you thought were radical, some of them end up running for Congress, and some of them end up being the authority on this and that. And you know they were wrong then, and they're even more wrong now. And you see, and you say to yourself, I can't get stuck here. The masses are moving. I can't get stuck here. What are they doing? What should I say? In other words, you have to be kind of like a midwife, like a, you don't, if you're a good doctor, you don't really heal people. You help people heal themselves. And if a woman is pregnant, this is a male chauvinist analysis, so forgive me. If a woman is pregnant, you can't make the baby, but you can help the baby be born. You know, help her give birth to her own child. So that's the kind of stuff that leads me. And when I teach in the classroom to me is a very holy place, but you know that there's certain students are motivated by certain things And you know that there's sometimes students are motivated by other things. And what you do is help them understand what they're doing while they are learning. You're not teaching them, you're not telling them what the facts are. You're helping them through the process of committing themselves to a process of learning. And you get reinforced because it pans out in a positive way as you go through your life. You know, and you meet other people who understand. And you can understand, you can see, when you see them, they know you. Like they say, game knows game.
Game recognizes game.
They recognize game, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you can tell somebody leaders who's out there ego tripping, and you don't need him around or her around you. That you don't recognize that kind of game you can't. It's not genuine game. So I might qualify genuine games meet genuine games. They recognize them. And you know that they got to have a genuine, healthy disrespect for all formalized authority. If they start respecting authority, you know, legitimate or illegitimate, they lost. They got to first. And certainly when I came up against my father, that's the first guy I had to come up with. That's the state right in the house that I grew up. I came up against him, you know. And after a while, he understood what I was doing. Game don't always recognize game at first. It might take a little while.
And I do appreciate that because, again, the definition of concepts become important, right?
And
so what you're talking about, folk are kind of engaging this, you're talking about experiences that can be used, or concepts, definition can be pulled out, or conceptualization could be pulled out of understanding an experience that also allows us to understand how we connect and build autonomous institutions. Yeah. And so, you know, this notion of direct democracy, the idea of autonomy, I want to go off on one of these side streets really quick, because I'm really interested in, as you were talking, and I was thinking, and I was, you know, leading up to formulating this particular question out of what you were just sharing with me. How does direct democracy and autonomy look in the context of Black studies today? Because Black studies, again, has these two strands. It's, you know, obviously it's very clear. There's a professionalization. There's a rooted in the Euro-American Academy. And then there's this contestation of those who are saying that it needs to move back, or that it should move back to its origins, coming directly from the masses. So how do we look at direct democracy, autonomy, educational practice in Black studies in this particular period?
Well, it's a task. It's the task that all of us face. But what we have to do is rewrite the history. I mean, really rewrite the history, not rewriting by substituting Black names for white people or doing events and stuff like that. You have to write so that you understand direct democracy as an organic physical part of human beings' quest in this world. It's not a new thing. It's always been there. So you have to point that out. That's what I'm doing right now. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at how in the Levant, how what they call the Sea People, how these people came from the East and just destroyed all those states that was emerging around the Nile Valley and all those places, ancient. And these people, they call them the Sea People. They don't know who they were, but they tore that, but they're looked at as being uncivilized. There's no record of it except through the kings of the people that they, so what they were trying to do is destroy, to me, when I see it, they were trying to destroy all the venerated societies that we know in the area. But when the venerated societies write the history, these people are uncivilized. They are the heathens. They're the unconscionables. They're the criminals. So what you have to do is give voice to those by some analytical tools that you develop. You know that a state voice or hierarchical pinnacle or hierarchical voice is simply a reflection of the oppressive society that gave rise to them. If you swallow, then you have to keep that method. When Black studies no longer is Black Studies. It's just a teaching of the human journey. Then they understand it like that. But Black Studies is really an attempt to legitimize the state among a certain section of rebellious people who were the Black people. So what you got to do then is go back in the history, figure out who these Sea people are. And when they destroyed Ramses, Egypt, you are not on Ramses' side. You know what I mean? When they come out of the sea and destroy the Hittites, and of course the book will say the Hittite Empire, you know that that's not an empire. You know that that's a hierarchical society which needed to be destroyed. So you know, you follow them and see how they did that. Not to look at for individuals, not for individuals, but look at the social process. And that then you'll see that that perhaps was the beginning of a flat society, which has not been documented. So what you got to do is document. And you have to look at all these stones and all these funny hieroglyphs, or look at the Egyptologists of the past, look at the empirical information that they put out there and reinterpret. Relook at what they're looking at, you know, because they're looking at what Ramses said, you know.
Go ahead.
About something like that now, trying to show that direct democracy has been always a part of human social development from the very earlier periods of time, and it's a constant period, and it's all around you, really. I mean, I hate to be mystical and everything. Like right now, people be saying that the Black church is so instrumental in doing this. Black church has been taken over by some elitist opportunists called preachers. That's what's happening. They're collecting money and exploiting people's ignorance. You have to say that in a way that's acceptable to people. You can't go in there and start worshiping with the preacher, Reverend Leroy. You can't do that. It's like right now. You think right now, we're embarking upon what they call a festive season. It ain't festive to me. It's a pagan holiday, which has existed from the time of early peripheral Israeli society under Roman Empire. You know, you have to interpret it like that, because that's the way it really is and was and is becoming. And then when you see a bully, you have to look at Ramses as a bully. That's who he was. Mm. And if you look at how they venerate Martin Luther King, how can Martin Luther King, tell me this, you tell me, how can this guy who didn't even live in Montgomery, from Atlanta, drove a big Buick, come in town and organize a bus boycott? He didn't ride a bus. And the people who organize it, they're not given credit for anything except following their leader, whether it's Jose Williams or Martin Luther King or Reverend Al Ralph, David Abernathy, Maynard Jackson, all these people. They're insignificant. You have to show how insignificant they are. Mm-hmm. No, you might not keep your job too long, but you can, just like what you're doing right now. Now, that's really some good stuff. Because it's like self-publishing, really. Mm. And you're laying out some empirical information that people can pick up on. Mm. You got me on here, crazy as I am. I tell my children, I say, really, I'm not writing for you. You don't understand it. just teach your grandchildren, teach my grandchildren to read. That's what I'm doing.
That is funny. I like that. You're like, it's not for you, it's for the children. Like,
teach them to read.
Yeah, teach them to read first. Yeah. I like that. That's very interesting. You know, one of the areas that you are looking.
By the way, I enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's inspiring. I get a kick out. You notice I like to laugh. That's another thing. Yeah. Find joy in.
Yeah. Oh. Listen.
For valid reasons.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm always ready for a good chuckle. One of the things and one of the areas that, and this is a big area because this is an area that I am really.
But let me just ask you a question directly.
Sure.
Sharpen your analytical tools so that when you write, you can get at what really is going on in human mass social history.
And pay attention to what is considered to be the periphery, right?
In the corner, in the back, in the dark.
Which is where I wanted to go specifically because, you know, they're Maroonish, you know, and this is one of the particular places where it's a rich area of focus, particularly for you, and really kind of seeing, you know, these notions of autonomy, these notions of direct democracy, but also, you know, what is happening in these particular spaces. How important is it to look at Maroonish or Maroons in the context of sharpening one's analytical perspectives, particularly as you have been doing and continuing to do?
Sorry, because they misrepresent these people. They look at them as uncivilized, undemocratic, unhinged and stuff. And these people were creating democratic societies and running away from what they call democracy and trying to create it on their own, away from them. And their story needs to be elevated. Really, it does. I just began. Those two instances people knew about. They knew something about it. But I mean, they were all over.
Today, we've just been listening to a portion of part two of a four-part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, Maroonage, Black anarchism, and atheism with Dr. Modibo Kadale. Dr. Modibo Kadale is a social ecologist, academic, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, Black power, and Pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. The full part two of the conversation between Dr. Modibo Kadale and African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope will be available on African Isles SoundCloud page. That's African Isles Online on SoundCloud. That's African Isles Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is We Will Win by Ezra Ngungukana. That's it for African Isles for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shainana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, and a special focus on the plight of Palestinians and the events in Syria at the moment. After that is the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder, and that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Compete Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nicella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Fonangonda. And our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs at WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Flying Bird, Anome by Osibisa, as we continue to remember Osibisa's founder, leader, Teddy Osei, who joined the ancestors yesterday, January 14, 2025. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week and stay safe. Thank you.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Israel and Hamas have agreed to a deal to halt fighting in Gaza, mediators announced today, and exchange Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. The agreement follows months of negotiations mediated by Egypt and Qatar with support from the United States and was reached just before the January 20 inauguration of U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. It will be up to the president-elect to implement the deal. The deal includes a 6-week initial ceasefire phase, a gradual withdrawal of Israeli forces, the release of hostages held by Hamas, and the release of Palestinian detainees held by Israel. Israel's campaign in Gaza has resulted in over 46,000 deaths, according to figures from Gaza's health ministry, and has reduced the strip to rubble. Hundreds of thousands of people are enduring the winter cold in tents and makeshift shelters. In other news, President Biden announced yesterday plans to remove the U.S. designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism as part of a deal that is expected to free protesters jailed during a sweeping 2021 crackdown on dissent by the Cuban government. The move will likely be overturned after the return to office next week of Donald Trump, who reinstated the designation in the last few days of his first term of office in 2021 after President Obama had removed it. Biden administration officials have long acknowledged there has been little justification for Cuba's presence on a list that will now include only North Korea, Iran, and Syria. In more international news, South Korean authorities detained President Yoon Suk-yeol early today following a 5-hour standoff involving thousands of law enforcement officials. Yoon is wanted for questioning in multiple criminal investigations related to his short-lived martial law decree, including over accusations of leading an insurrection, which is a crime punishable by life imprisonment or even the death penalty. Under the current warrant, Yoon can be held for up to 48 hours from the point of arrest. A new warrant is then needed to detain him while he continues to be investigated. In a 3-minute video released just before his arrest, Yoon said he would cooperate with the investigators while repeating previous claims that the warrant was not legally valid. Yoon has already been impeached by South Korean lawmakers and suspended from office, but will remain in office until the Constitutional Court ratifies the impeachment. And in domestic news, more strong winds are forecast for the Los Angeles area today, bringing with them the threat of new or expanded blazes as crews work tirelessly to prevent further spread. The National Weather Service issued a high-level, particularly dangerous situation warning through 3 p.m. local time today and extended a red flag warning through Thursday for some areas north of the city. While cooler temperatures are expected over the weekend, weather officials say any reprieve will probably be brief, with Santa Ana windstorms predicted to potentially return Monday and no rain forecast for at least the next week. At least 25 people have died in the fires. As of Tuesday, about 88,000 residents in the county remained under mandatory evacuation orders, while authorities urged another 84,000 residents under evacuation warnings